Good morning and welcome to the Tuesday edition of Times the Brief. I'm Harvey Kojan, and these are the top stories of the day. Plainclothes officers arrested immigrants at a courthouse. Can they do that? By Maya Roden. Representatives of Immigration and Customs Enforcement say that the arrests of undocumented immigrants last week by plainclothes officers who did not identify themselves to bystanders outside a Brooklyn courthouse were allowed under current policy. Under the Trump administration, arrests at courthouses have become a common occurrence, much to the chagrin of immigration attorneys and immigrant rights advocates. But the arrests last week gained attention after a defense lawyer tweeted about the plainclothes officers, and a journalist who came to the courthouse reported that they refused to identify themselves. In a statement, Immigration and Customs Enforcement spokeswoman Rachel Young Yao said the four individuals who were arrested were members of or affiliated with a gang and all had pending criminal charges, adding that courthouse visitors are typically screened upon entry, making arrests inside such facilities far safer for everyone involved. Under current policy, immigration officers are directed to avoid enforcement activities at locations that are deemed sensitive, including places of worship, schools, and hospitals, but courthouses are not included on the list. According to ICE, officers only carry out courthouse arrests after they've exhausted other options, and those they target are typically foreign nationals with prior criminal convictions or pending charges or are threats to public safety. The New York State Unified Court System issued guidelines in April on how law enforcement activities can be carried out in courthouses. They are required to check in, judges are to be notified, and officers cannot make arrests in courtrooms except under extraordinary circumstances. Lucien Chalfin, the Director of Public Information for the New York State Unified Court System, says the ICE officers were at the Brooklyn courthouse to speak with an assistant district attorney from the borough. After speaking with them, they left. Both ICE and Chalfin say the four arrests took place outside of the courthouse. Slate reported that ICE officers did not identify themselves when they were asked by journalists on the scene, but they don't necessarily have to. An ICE spokesperson tells Time that officers determine the level of visibility they want to have in these situations after taking the conditions of their surroundings into account. In high visibility situations, ICE officers use several means to identify themselves, including, but not limited to, wearing placards or clothing that clearly identifies them as immigration officers, an ICE spokesperson told Time via email. However, in certain situations, high visibility hinders or endangers safety, and officers may decide not to broadcast their identity. Officers are required to identify themselves if they're interacting with them as a part of their official duties, no matter what the situation is, however. Former acting ICE Director John Sandweg tells Time that courthouse operations are a sensitive issue because of the chilling effect it could have on those who need court services. But once officers are on the premises, he says, it's understandable that they may decide not to identify themselves under certain circumstances, since that could jeopardize an operation or put them at risk. While I do have concerns about courthouse enforcement, I have less concerns about their refusal to identify themselves necessarily to the public at large or to reporters, Sandweg says. There are going to be certain times where, for operational effectiveness, they don't want to immediately identify themselves. Lee Wang, a staff attorney at the Immigrant Defense Project, says the fact that the officers did not identify themselves to reporters aligns with reports she's heard from attorneys. The standard report that we get from attorneys that witness these arrests is that ICE refuses to say who they are, they refuse to identify themselves, they refuse to answer yes or no when asked directly whether or not they're with ICE, and they refuse to provide any kind of paperwork from ICE showing that they have some type of administrative warrant for the arrest, Wang says. Under the Trump administration, Immigration and Customs Enforcement officers have been granted more authority to carry out enforcement operations and arrests of undocumented immigrants. That freedom, which has been described by proponents as the unshackling of ICE agents, has raised concerns among immigrant advocates and officials who've said some arrests have a chilling effect on undocumented immigrants who need to interact with the justice system. I think it engenders mass fear. It makes it even more frightening for non-citizens to enter our courthouses because you don't know who might be lurking in the corner, Wang says. Lawyers and law enforcement officials in states such as Colorado and Texas have raised concerns about the courthouse arrests, but the Trump administration has shown no signs of backing away from the practice. When the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of California wrote a letter to Attorney General Jeff Sessions and then Homeland Security Chief John Kelly asking the federal government to end the practice, the Attorney General responded to her request by criticizing the state's so-called sanctuary city policies. The Real Reason Airplanes Still Have Ashtrays by Joseph Hinks. It's a quintessential in-flight riddle, a perennial that comes on mid-red-eye and is forgotten by the time the wheels touch down. If smoking is banned on planes, what's with all the ashtrays? Think about it. There are illuminated signs above the seats. There's the pre-takeoff safety demonstration that reminds you that tampering with the smoke detectors is a criminal offense. There's the sign on the bathroom door. Then, right below that sign, there's the ashtray. U.S. Airlines started banning smoking back in the late 1980s. By the end of 1990, it was prohibited on all domestic flights under 6 hours in duration, according to CNN. And since 2000, the smoking ban has been pretty much ubiquitous internationally. So does that mean the planes we're all flying on are all super old? Thankfully not. You're not allowed to smoke, but some people still do it. A cabin attendant on a Cathay Pacific flight bound for London says, adding that she catches somebody about every 6 months. So if you do smoke, there has to be a safe place to stub it out. That safe place is emphatically not the lavatory's waste bin, which is liable to be filled with flammable tissues. There are good reasons for airlines to be cautious. In 1972, 123 passengers were killed on a plane traveling from Rio de Janeiro to Paris when the pilot made an emergency landing after the cabin filled with smoke. The suspected cause? A cigarette. Now, ashtrays in bathrooms are listed as a legal requirement for minimum equipment by the Federal Aviation Administration. So seriously is the regulation taken that in 2009 a Mexico-bound British Airways flight was grounded after it was discovered not to be packing any ashtrays. So there you have it. Ashtrays on planes are not relics. Neither are they an invitation to smoke. They're basically there because the FAA doesn't trust you not to. These are the cities where people exercise the most. By David Johnson. Exercise is on the rise among Americans, particularly among millennials, according to a new report from Gallup and ShareCare, a health and wellness company. They found that 53.4% of Americans reported exercising 3 or more times a week, a 2 percentage point increase from 2008, and a modest increase from more recent years. The new figure is based on surveys of 177,000 people nationwide in 2016. The city with the highest exercise rate was Boulder, Colorado, where nearly 70% of residents say they exercise 3 or more times a week. Two other metropolitan areas in Colorado, Fort Collins and Greeley, also topped the list at 2nd and 4th place, respectively. Communities in California and Hawaii followed closely behind. As you might expect, the communities with the highest levels of reported exercise are also among the communities with the highest well-being overall, says lead researcher Dan Witters. That reflects the impact that exercise has on well-being. Here's your top 10 communities with the highest rates of regular exercise. Number 1, Boulder, Colorado, 69.6%. Number 2, Fort Collins, Colorado, 67.9%. Number 3, San Luis Obispo, Paso Robles, California, 67%. Number 4, Greeley, Colorado, 65.3%. Number 5, Santa Rosa, California, 62.3%. Number 6, Urban Honolulu, Hawaii, 61.4%. Tied at number 6, Hilton Head Island, Bluffton, Beaufort, South Carolina, at 61.4%. Number 8, Anchorage, Alaska, 61.3%. Number 9, Clarksville, Tennessee, Kentucky, 61%. And rounding out the top 10, Chico, California, 60.9%. And the communities with the lowest rates of regular exercise, number 180, Roanoke, Virginia, 47.5%. Number 181, Rockford, Illinois, 47.4%. Number 182, Gulfport, Biloxi, Pascagoula, Mississippi, 47.3%. Number 183, Spartanburg, South Carolina, 46.6%. Number 184, Buffalo, Cheektowaga, Niagara Falls, New York, 46.5%. Number 185, Toledo, Ohio, 46.5%. Number 186, Montgomery, Alabama, 45.7%. Number 187, Cedar Rapids, Iowa, 45.6%. Number 188, Akron, Ohio, 45%. And the community with the lowest rate of regular exercise in the United States, at number 189, Hickory, Morganton, North Carolina, 41.8%. Witters wasn't surprised by the cities atop the list. Boulder has a very tangible culture of well-being, lots of bike paths, lots of built structure that makes the healthy choice the easy choice. He says the same is true about almost every other high-ranking community. These are places that have invested in walkability, green spaces, and public areas where people can get together and move, all things that have proven to increase the chance of lots of people exercising in your area, he says. Boulder's affluence is also a factor, explains Witters, as higher-income people report exercising more often, according to demographic data. Higher income is linked with better health literacy, health insurance, and access to health care services and exercise facilities. The overall increase in exercise rates is driven in part by young adults ages 18 to 29 who are exercising more than that age group did 10 years ago. The millennials are improving across a wide variety of health metrics since 2008, while all the older generations are kind of flat, Witters says. Three Things to Expect in President Trump's United Nations Speech by Alana Abramson. President Trump will give his first address to the United Nations Tuesday, an organization with which he has a bit of a controversial history. As a candidate and a president, Trump has often espoused an America First policy that doesn't always align neatly with the values of international cooperation that define the UN. At one point during his campaign, he even decried the organization's utter weakness and incompetence. The criticism only continued after he was elected, with Trump characterizing it on Twitter as a club for people who get together, talk, and have a good time. But the White House said Monday that while Trump will emphasize the values that make America unique, he will also stress the need for international cooperation, particularly when it comes to addressing issues like terrorism and the nuclear capabilities of North Korea and Iran, both of which are expected to factor prominently into the speech. Here's a look at what we know about the content of Tuesday's address. The speech will be similar to ones in Saudi Arabia and Poland. When Trump visited Saudi Arabia in May, he delivered a speech at a summit where he urged Muslim nations to purge the extremists within the religion and argued that good will ultimately prevail over evil. His remarks were a deviation from his past rhetoric, where he's blamed Islam as a whole for terrorism. But his speech in Warsaw, Poland, 6 weeks later had a decidedly different tone, emphasizing the need to preserve Western civilization and values in an era fraught with terrorism. His upcoming speech at the UN, according to the White House, will contain aspects of both of these speeches. This speech sort of continues and does continue that progression, and in front of the United Nations explains both a vision for burden sharing among nations towards shared goals as at the same time a defense of our civilizational values and what makes us special, a senior administration official said on a briefing call with reporters Monday. Trump will criticize North Korea and Iran. The White House said that the speech will focus on both Iran and North Korea, emphasizing the role all countries need to play in taming these countries' nuclear ambitions, particularly in regards to North Korea. The president is also expected to address Venezuela, which is currently embroiled in economic and political turmoil. But the administration declined to provide specifics about whether the speech will contain policy prescriptions and did not respond to several questions about whether Trump will mention Russia. When pressed for specifics about what Trump would say about Iran, the administration official said he will emphasize the gulf between the country's leadership and the dissatisfaction of the country's citizens. One of the strategic implications of the speech is to point out that one of the greatest threats to the endurance of the status quo in Iran is the Iranian people themselves, the official explained. On Monday, President Trump met with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who's an avid opponent of the 2015 Iranian nuclear deal. When asked by reporters if the U.S. would withdraw from the deal, Trump only replied, "You'll be seeing very soon." He'll discuss applying America First on an international stage. Although promoting an America First policy, which places a priority on promoting domestic progress, may seem incompatible with international cooperation, the White House insists that the two actually go hand in hand, and that Trump will expand upon this connection in his speech. By delineating the benefits of an America First policy, the White House says, Trump is emphasizing the importance of sovereignty, which is a crucial ingredient for successful international cooperation. What the president is doing is explaining how the principle of America First is not only consistent with the goal of international cooperation, but a rational basis for every country to engage in cooperation, because all countries that are sovereign put the needs of their own citizens first, and therefore countries that confront, as I said before, common dangers, common threats, common opportunities ought to be able to cooperate together as a coalition of strong, free, and independent nations to confront these shared dangers, said the administration official. Catastrophic Category 5 storm Maria lashes Dominica. Hurricane Maria swept over the small island of Dominica with catastrophic winds overnight, starting a charge into the eastern Caribbean that threatens islands already devastated by Hurricane Irma and holds the possibility of a direct hit on Puerto Rico. Fierce winds and driving rain lashed mountainous Dominica for hours as Maria caused flooding and tore roofs from homes as an extremely dangerous Category 5 storm. A police official on the island said late Monday there were no immediate reports of casualties, but it was too dangerous for officers to do a full assessment as the storm raged outside. "Where we are, we can't move," he said in a brief phone interview while hunkered down against the region's second Category 5 hurricane this month. By early Tuesday, Maria weakened slightly to a still major Category 4 storm after pounding the small Caribbean island nation, but forecasters cautioned that fluctuations in intensity were to be expected. Dominica's prime minister earlier captured the fury of Maria as it made landfall. "The winds are merciless. We shall survive by the grace of God," he wrote at the start of a series of increasingly harrowing posts on Facebook. A few minutes later, he messaged he could hear the sound of galvanized steel roofs tearing off houses on the small, rugged island. He then wrote that he thought his home had been damaged, and three words, "rough, rough, rough." A half hour later, he said, "My roof is gone. I am at the complete mercy of the hurricane. House is flooding." 7 minutes later, he posted that he had been rescued. Officials in Guadalupe said the French island near Dominica probably would experience heavy flooding and warned that many communities could be submerged. In nearby Martinique, authorities ordered people to remain indoors and said they should be prepared for power cuts and disruption in the water supply. Authorities in the U.S. territory of Puerto Rico warned that people in wooden or flimsy homes should find safe shelter before the storm's expected arrival there on Wednesday. "You have to evacuate, otherwise you're going to die," said Hector Pesquera, the island's public safety commissioner. "I don't know how to make this any clearer." Maria had maximum sustained winds of 160 miles an hour late Monday as it slammed into Dominica, its eye passing over the island before conditions began easing. Early Tuesday, a Hurricane Hunter plane found top winds had slightly weakened, though Maria remained a still extremely dangerous Category 4 major storm. The U.S. National Hurricane Center said Maria's top sustained winds were clocked at 155 miles an hour at 2 a.m. and that the eye of Maria was about 45 miles west-northwest of Dominica. The storm was moving west-northwest at 9 miles per hour. Before the latest fluctuation in intensity, forecasters had warned Maria would likely intensify over the next 24 hours or longer, noting its eye had shrunk to a compact 10 miles across and warning Maria is developing the dreaded pinhole eye. That generally means an extremely strong hurricane will get even mightier, said Brian McNulty, a hurricane researcher at the University of Miami. He said, "It's just like when a spinning ice skater brings in their arms and rotates faster. You just don't see those in weaker hurricanes," he said. The storm's hurricane-force winds extended out about 35 miles and tropical storm-force winds out as far as 125 miles. Hurricane warnings were posted for the U.S. and British Virgin Islands, Puerto Rico, Guadalupe, Dominica, St. Kitts, Nevis, and Montserrat. A tropical storm warning was issued for Martinique, Antigua and Barbuda, Saba, St. Eustatius, St. Martin, St. Lucia, and Anguilla. Forecasters said storm surge could raise water levels by 6 to 9 feet near the storm center. The storm was predicted to bring 10 to 15 inches of rain across the islands, with more in isolated areas. The current forecast track would carry it about 22 miles south of St. Croix in the U.S. Virgin Islands late Tuesday and early Wednesday. "We are going to have a very, very long night," said the territorial governor Kenneth Mapp, as he urged people in the territory to finish any preparations. St. Thomas and St. John are still stunned from a direct hit by Hurricane Irma, which did extensive damage and caused 4 deaths on the two islands. Barry University said it chartered a private plane to carry students and staff from its St. Croix facility to Florida in preparation for Maria. It said 72 people connected to the Barry's Physician Assistant Program and a few pets were on Monday's evacuation flight. In neighboring Puerto Rico, nearly 70,000 people were still without power following their earlier brush with Irma, and nearly 200 remained in shelters as Maria approached. Governor Ricardo Rossello said Puerto Rico had 500 shelters capable of taking in up to 133,000 people in a worst-case scenario. He also said the Federal Emergency Management Agency was ready to bring drinking water and help restore power immediately after the storm, which could hit as a Category 5 hurricane. "That is catastrophic in every way," said Roberto Garcia with the National Weather Service in San Juan. "People have to act, and they have to act now. They can no longer wait for a miracle." To the north, Hurricane Jose stirred up dangerous surf and rip currents along the U.S. East Coast, though forecasters said the storm was unlikely to make landfall. Big waves caused by the storm swept 5 people off a coastal jetty in Rhode Island, and they were hospitalized after being rescued. A tropical storm warning was posted for coastal areas in Rhode Island and Massachusetts, and tropical storm watches were up for parts of New York's Long Island and Connecticut. Jose's center was about 395 miles south of Nantucket, Massachusetts, early Tuesday, and moving north at 8 miles per hour. The storm had maximum sustained winds of 75 miles per hour. Graduates of this hot college program are earning $200,000 right out of school. By Rob Weil. CNBC reports Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh is spinning out graduates earning $200,000 to work in the rapidly growing field of self-driving cars. Pittsburgh has become America's unofficial self-driving car research capital. At least 4 companies in the autonomous vehicle business, including Uber, have set up offices in the city. They've been testing its self-driving cars on Pittsburgh streets since 2016. Andrew Moore, the dean of Carnegie Mellon's Computer Science School, said that graduates of its computer vision program are getting job offers from these firms with pay packages of upwards of $200,000 right out of school. It's a situation that's unheard of for any role until recently, Moore said. It does feel very much like a gold rush town at the moment, he added. Computer science and engineering are always ranked among the highest paid college majors, but it's fairly rare even for engineers and computer science majors to earn over $100,000 right after graduating, let alone $200,000. Computer vision is a specialized field focused on enabling computers and other machines to see as well or even better than a human. It's obviously an essential subject of research for companies in the business of self-driving cars. Carnegie Mellon's program costs a hefty $68,000 a year, but what with the lofty salaries commanded by graduates, the program can quickly pay for itself for students. Moore estimates there are up to 2,000 computer vision grads working in Pittsburgh right now.
CCleaner Malware Hack, What to Know and How to Protect Yourself, by Matt Peckham. If you use a software tool called CCleaner to keep your Windows PC humming smoothly, keep reading. The utility was just indicted by Purifoam, the British company that makes CCleaner, in a troubling blog post. In short, it seems a recent version of CCleaner, as well as a related product, CCleaner Cloud, the online version, were infiltrated by hackers and weaponized with malware of the sort that harvests and transmits user data for nefarious purposes. The activity was discovered on September 12th, and while Purifoam says it's already patched CCleaner Cloud, users running CCleaner will need to upgrade immediately. Here's everything you need to know. What is CCleaner? CCleaner, which software maker Purifoam bills as the number one tool for cleaning your PC, is a software optimization tool designed to tidy up Windows PC by removing extraneous software and browser data. It's available in both free and paid versions, including a professional business profile. All versions include claimed computer speedups and privacy protection, while the paid versions add extras like real-time monitoring, scheduling, automatic updates, and better support. CCleaner Cloud is the online version of the tool, designed to perform similar duties but on a broad array of computers centrally controlled through a web browser. Since Purifoam controls this version of the tool in-house, it's already been updated to eliminate the malware, says the company. What just happened to CCleaner? Purifoam says it first detected a problem on September 12th when it noticed an unknown IP address receiving data from software found in recent versions of the software. After investigating further, it determined these versions were modified illicitly before the release to users. How many people are at risk? Avest, the multinational cybersecurity firm that recently bought Purifoam, says it believes the compromised software was installed on 2.27 million machines. We believe that these users are safe now, as our investigation indicates we were able to disarm the threat before it was able to do any harm, the company said in a press statement. There is no indication or evidence that any additional malware has been delivered through the back door, it added. Am I at risk for malware? Anyone specifically using the 32-bit Windows version of CCleaner is at risk. But since the free version of the tool doesn't appear to include automatic updates, it stands to reason that anyone running the free version is significantly more at risk, since these users would need to manually download the update. Regardless, if you're running any version of CCleaner, you want to ensure you've updated to the latest version recently. Which versions of CCleaner have the malware? Purifoam says it believes the 32-bit Windows version 5.33.6162 of CCleaner and version 5.07.3191 of CCleaner Cloud were modified illicitly before the release to users. What does the malware do? According to Avast, the malware attempts to transmit information like computer names, IP addresses, installed software, active running software, network adapter information, and more to a server located in the United States. What is Purifoam doing to remedy the problem? The company has already updated both the online and downloadable versions of CCleaner. It has also contacted law enforcement and says it's worked with them on resolving the issue. The company also says that the threat has now been resolved in the sense that the rogue server is down, other potential servers are out of control of the attacker, and removing all existing CCleaner v5.33.6162 users to the latest version. In other words, says the company, to the best of our knowledge, we were able to disarm the threat before it was able to do any harm. What version of CCleaner eliminates the malware? Puriform says users should update CCleaner to version 5.34 or higher. Who hacked CCleaner? It's not yet clear, and Puriform is declining to speculate. The company says the investigation is still ongoing. Is there anything else Puriform needs to do? The company has already apologized for the incident and says it is taking detailed steps internally so that this does not happen again. At the very least, it would seem adding automatic updates to all future iterations of its products, including the free ones, would go a long way toward mitigating potential future threats.
Sean Spicer's Emmy's appearance rewarded his lies with fame by David Litt. This will be the largest audience to witness the Emmys, period, both in person and around the world. So declared Sean Spicer, the supposed-to-be-disgraced former press secretary, during a surprise guest at the Emmys last night. If Hollywood is a hotbed of anti-Trump sentiment, you wouldn't have known it last night, after his brief appearance making fun of the most famous time he lied to the American people, the supposedly disgraced press secretary posed backstage for pictures with celebs. I'm all in support of well-placed humor, especially for politicians. I just wrote a book on my time writing speeches and jokes, plenty of them self-effacing, for President Obama. But this wasn't that. Before joining the Trump administration, Spicer was a typical Republican hack. He spun, often furiously, but drew the line at outright lies. But last night, he didn't express the tiniest hint of remorse for committing professional malpractice or creating an atmosphere in which no claim from the White House, from the size of a crowd to the effects of a hurricane, can be believed. This wasn't an apology tour. This was a bragging tour. This was an "I'm getting away with it right now because I let the American people down and you're applauding me for it" tour. In the end, however, the blame doesn't lie with Spicer. He was given a golden opportunity to turn what ought to be a moment of professional humiliation into 15 minutes of fame. Why not take it? No, the mistake was made by whoever decided to bring Spicer on in the first place. What we saw last night is that for all their attacks on Hollywood liberals, what the GOP elite want more than anything is to be embraced by the culture they claim to be at war with. They want to be applauded at Hamilton, despite supporting a racist candidate. They want to be welcome in fancy French restaurants, even as they attack cosmopolitans and globalists. Most of all, they want pictures with celebrities to bask in the glow of famous persons. Even for just a moment is kind of an American dream, and they are anything but immune. Which means that, for elites anyway, the most powerful form of resistance is social shame. Don't invite Ivanka, Jared, or Gary Cohn to fancy dinner parties. Don't treat Steve Bannon as a thought leader on 60 Minutes. When Anthony Scaramucci wants those hard-to-get theater tickets, tell him to kiss off, or even better, use the kind of language he'd understand. I'm not suggesting that this social pressure should apply to Republicans, but it should apply to Trumpists. It's the price you pay for willingly joining an administration that runs a racist campaign, argues there's both sides to Nazism, and colludes with Russia to undermine the United States. So yes, there's a place for former White House staff in comedy. At least I sure hope there is. But it wasn't the Emmys. Not for Sean Spicer. Not last night.
Dar Williams, How to Make Your Town Somewhere Everyone Wants to Live, by Dar Williams. It doesn't start with love. If you want to live in a great town, but you're not quite there yet, you don't just start to build that town with love, peace, civility, or morality. You start with a hill. You say to yourself, that hill off the side of the high school would be perfect for sledding. I know someone who could mow it with his riding mower. You call that guy and ask. He says, sure. On an early Saturday morning in late September when the streets are empty, he drives over on the main roads and mows the hill. You hand him a coffee and tell him your idea. He says, pointing, after it snows, you should get someone to just tamp it down, establish the track so the kids don't end up in the junk trees there. You imagine thorny branches, kids with broken legs and stitches. Lawsuits, condemnation, yes, tamping, tracks, good idea. I know a guy with a plow, this guy says. I'll get him to make a track when the first snow falls. The snow falls and the plow guy comes. He makes 4 parallel tracks and sends his niece over with a sled. You invite your kids and some of their friends to take a maiden run. All parties inform you that it's awesome. By afternoon, there are 20 kids. Now the parents talk while the children sled. A woman shyly approaches and says, "I'm on the PTA, and I was wondering if I could sell hot chocolate for a suggested donation. We're trying to fund some enrichment programs." "Anyone can do anything," you say. "I have no claim on this. I just knew a couple of guys." Over the course of the winter, the PTA makes $800 on hot chocolate and coffee sales. When people see it's for the PTA, they round up their donations as generously as they can. It's not a wealthy town, but still. By the next year, the mowing guy knows a tree guy who's cleared away the junk trees to make more room for sledding. The PTA woman who sold the hot chocolate has been talking about what the school is up to, what it could use. People offer to teach after-school programs and make school visits. One woman can come in to sing. Would that be helpful? One woman has a python. Should she bring it? A librarian asks what the library can do. By the next year, the sledding hill is the place to go. People bake for the PTA table, and the local farm is the milk sponsor. The PTA has accumulated a fleet of volunteers who tutor at the school. The woman from the PTA is dating the guy with the mower. The library and school are coordinating events. Someone has started a small concert and reading series at the base of the sledding hill in the summer because the slope of the hill is like a natural amphitheater. Next year, someone wants to run an outdoor film series. There's talk of a small community herb garden, and someone has approached the guy with a plow about starting a tool library. He says he'll talk to the gal at the VFW hall. Maybe they could do it there. That's when a father from another town, watching his kids speed down the hill, turns to you and says, "This is a great town. I wish we lived here." What this town is building, aside from new trails and a better school, is positive proximity, or a state of being where living side by side with other people is experienced as beneficial. I've been seeing this phenomenon of town building for more than 20 years. Someone starts something, others join in, and then everything starts to shift into more clarity, more resilience, more goodwill, and more pride. Libraries find their way into the digital age. Schools improve. People actually sit and eat ice cream on the benches eerily empty for years. I've seen the power of positive proximity firsthand in hundreds of towns such as Lowell, Massachusetts, hit with the twin degradations of industrial downturns and a crack epidemic in the 1990s. I saw it in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, where, after the R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company left the state in 1995, the promoters of my near-empty concert were vowing that they would revive the city through the arts. Good luck with that, I thought. They did have very good luck with that. I didn't understand the power of the positive proximity I had witnessed until I was having dinner at my friend Kate's house in Charlottesville, Virginia. Her husband, Hal Movius, who writes books about conflict resolution, filled my wine glass and asked, "What do you think determines the relationships we'll have in our towns?" Hal loves to pore through Harvard studies and explain them to dinner guests. I said, "Values? No. Politics? No again. Hobbies? Wrong." Hal said, "Proximity. That's all." I disagreed. Into my mind came full-blown images provided by news headlines of neighbors fighting over parking spaces and fallen tree branches. I'd just heard the story of a company that could identify DNA in dog poop so people could know the genetic fingerprint, as it were, of the anonymous offenses in their courtyards. Early clients were co-op associations. But then I realized with a jolt the study Hal was referring to was right. When people transcend the myth that proximity means conflict and invasion of privacy, they gravitate toward finding ways to integrate the talents and skills of their community members. Not only that, after people discover each other in the commons of town, more connections are made, and the next thing you know, you're Lowell, Massachusetts, that small city that had a terrible drug problem, but now has 5 museums, a popular minor league stadium and team, and a free concert series that attracts thousands of families every summer. I see towns and cities as being like people who build some framework of identity that allows them to assert themselves, do good work, and know where they stand. I find myself almost befriending them, wanting to introduce them to each other. Peoria, Illinois, have you met Cedar Rapids, Iowa? Seattle, Washington, you have some interesting things in common with Asheville, North Carolina. Gardner, Maine, I think Dover, New Hampshire could provide some helpful insights as you continue the winning streak you're on with your downtown. Over time, I've detected certain simple patterns that facilitate positive proximity. There are three essential categories for building and growing it. First, there are spaces, indoors and out, that naturally maximize the number of good interactions in a town. Generally, these spaces have some individual character while still being open enough to accommodate the desires and interests of diverse citizens. Second, there are projects that build a town's identity, socially, culturally, and/or historically, helping them become themselves. These projects bring out the advantages of proximity by attracting the passions and skill sets of people who are like-minded in some ways, but very different in others, cross-pollinating abilities and personalities. Citizens tend to see past their partisanship and biases when they're trying to accomplish something they can't do alone, such as plant a community garden or start a riverfront music series. These projects remind us, whether we're building the scaffolding, installing the floor joists, or attending events in the finished barn, that collective pursuits are achievable. Creating or discovering a town's identity can be the ongoing proof that positive proximity exists. You can feel it in the air. Third, there is the abstract quality that I call translation. Translation is essential for positive proximity to take root and grow. Translation is all the acts of communication that open up a town to itself and to the world. Translation is not to be mistaken for civility. Translation includes a tacit commitment to facilitating all the variegated voices and personalities in our towns. Whether it's the shy math whiz student who has an uncanny technique for explaining algebra to struggling students, the eccentric obsessed with cleaning up the local cemetery, the community banker dad who wants to learn how to coach 7-year-olds in soccer, benevolent dictatorship all the way, the neurotic though brilliant lawyer who steps in to talk her town through a zoning issue, translation is the ability of a place to incorporate every willing citizen's contributions and, in so doing, find ways to make life more interesting, welcome the outside world, and provide stability for those who need support, because strong positive proximity means that no one gets left behind. When towns have any or all of these components of spaces, identity-building projects, and translation, they grow, they become more self-determining, and they thrive. No one starts with the word love, but in many towns I visited, something happens after the sledding hill, the playing fields, the concert series, and the local festivals start opening up a world of local relationships. There is a warmth and wonder in the expressions of the residents. They say, "I love it here. I belong here. I can't imagine living anywhere else." Some people even go from saying, "I live here," to, "I'm from here." There is one preliminary question that will help you gauge the positive proximity in your town and your relationship to it. You probably know where you live, but where are you from and where do you belong?
Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the daily edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.